Hello, everyone, and welcome to Energy Security Cubed, where we explore the pillars that form the nexus of energy security in Canada and the world, energy, economics, and the environment. I am your host, CEO and President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Kelly Ogle. On today's episode, recorded July 27, 2021, we discuss the future of LNG in Asia, the policies and market dynamics that are promoting or opposing LNG, the potential for hydrogen as a replacement for LNG, and the relationship of all of this to energy security. Really pleased to have joining me today from Oslo, Norway, Shi Nan. Shi is Vice President of Gas and Power Markets at Rystad Energy's Markets Team, where she focuses on LNG markets as well as product development. She holds a Master of Science degree in Finance from BI Norwegian Business School. She was previously a Senior Analyst and Content Manager at Thomson Reuters Norway and an analyst at Econ Pore Management Consulting in Norway. Welcome, Shi. We're very happy to have you.
Thank you.
Before we get into the LNG question, and there's been some interesting developments in the recent past about the LNG that I'd like to bring up, can you tell us a bit about Rystad and what it does?
Sure. Rystad Energy is an independent energy consulting and business intelligence house providing data, tools, analytics, and consulting services to clients basically globally. Our high-end expertise lies in energy fundamentals, oil and gas markets, supply chains, renewables, and energy transition. The fundamental element to our business is really bottom-up approach to data and the consistent micro to macro intelligence. Rystad Energy was founded in 2004, headquartered in Oslo, Norway, and currently has 21 offices globally.
It's a very large consultancy, isn't it? So you and your clients would run the gamut of large to small companies, including state-owned enterprises and big service firms too, I would think.
Yes.
And shipping and all of the things that are in the energy spectrum. I think that people sometimes need to appreciate the enormity of everything that makes it all kind of come together.
Yeah, exactly.
Recently, there's been a flurry of long-term LNG supply deals signed in East Asia, including a five-year deal between Shell and PetroChina, a 10-year deal between Petronas and CNOOC, and a 20-year deal between Qatar and South Korea. Has the pace of these LNG deals in East Asia been generally above or below expectations, in your opinion?
It's a very good question. More or less the same as we expected, but you never guess the level, right, before you really saw those deals coming in. Around 22 term LNG deals have been signed so far this year, with contract volume totaling around 28 million tons per annum. As a comparison, 25 term deals were closed last year. The total contract volume was about 30 million tons per annum. So the contracts signed in the first 7 months of 2021 have almost reached the level of the entire 2020. In addition, Russia's Arctic LNG 2 project has sold all its 19.8 million tons per annum to the project stakeholders through 20-year sales and purchase agreements. So 2021 is very much likely to be the most fruitful year when it comes to contract volume, ever since 2013 when Fukushima's disaster happened. And this is not really a surprise, given the expansion on the supply side and also the increasing gas demand on the buy side, with more flexible pricing terms, of course. On the supply side, Qatar Petroleum finally made a final investment decision this February from its Train 8 to 11, 31.2 MTPA capacity from the North Field Expansion Project. And given the low break-even cost of the new trains, Qatar can offer long-term supply with competitive prices. In the US, Telluran has recently closed two contracts, 3 million tons per annum each with Gunvor and Vitol, both indexed to JKM and TTF. In Canada, the 2.2 million tons per annum Petronas CNOOC deal will source gas from the LNG Canada project for 10 years with pricing indexed to Brent and AECO, the gas price benchmark in Canada. So this does not happen often, indexed to AECO, but we really see the new pricing formula coming to the market.
I think though that you just hit on a very interesting point that I think needs to be understood, or I think at least brought to the conversation. The buyers are looking for longer term deals. Like they're prepared to pay up a little bit in, as compared to, like you say, AECO or whatever, to make sure they've got supply at reasonable prices, which again, I always reiterate in my podcast, energy security is adequate supply at a price that's affordable. And these buyers have to look out for their societies. Is that not true?
Yeah, precisely. So on the demand side, China announced its 2060 carbon neutrality goal, and gas is definitely believed to play a key role to support this ambitious goal. China has signed about 13 million tons per annum term contracts so far this year. As you mentioned, it's really securing the long-term gas or LNG coming to the energy mix, and we expect the trend to continue in the coming years. On the other hand, the emerging markets, for example, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, also need LNG to support this power generation and industrial sectors. Those countries normally don't have cross-border pipelines or much domestic production. They need LNG sort of to support their energy transition. And also, it's worth mentioning that when we see market being very volatile, portfolio deals are usually very active.
Yeah, I think that oftentimes people get hung up in the supply in the food chain at China, Japan, the big industrial countries in East Asia, and forget that Bangladesh, Pakistan, India, these countries a little bit further west are certainly just as much in need of high quality delivered fuel for power generation. And I think that you've touched on a very good point. But let's swing over to the Shell PetroChina deal and change gears a little bit. The claims are that this LNG will be offset by carbon credits from nature-based projects. Could you elaborate on that a little bit? And do you see this kind of agreement becoming more common in the LNG trade in East Asia?
This is a very, very good question. You know, carbon neutral LNG has been a very popular topic during the past 2 years. So far, around 15 deals were made on per cargo basis from 2019 so to date. And so all these 15 cargoes are not indexed to, like, not really based on the long-term basis. In addition, Pavilion Energy signed term deals with Qatar Petroleum, Chevron, and BP. But this is more like a statement of the greenhouse gas emissions, not really carbon neutral. So we call such deals as carbon conscious deals, not really carbon neutral deals. And the recent Shell PetroChina deal is believed as the world's first carbon neutral LNG contract on a term basis. The credits will come from Shell's global portfolio of forestry projects and cover the CO2 emissions across the entire value chain. Of course, carbon neutral LNG deals are attractive to countries that set ambitious climate targets and also rely on LNG imports for the energy transition. More of such deals are expected to continue, of course, in our view.
So do you think that this is and I'm sure that this deal had been being negotiated for several months, if not a year, but do you think this is partly a reaction by Shell to their getting their hands slapped by the government of the Netherlands? Like, you know, they're trying to, it's certainly not a Shell game, but that's a bad analogy, but it's a, you know, this carbon neutrality seems to have just completely encompassed the narrative. You know, it's interesting, but countries, you know, the entities still need to find their way to energy that's sustainable.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's not this isn't a zero sum game. We're a long way to go.
Yeah, sure. Just add a few things that I think we need to notice. The first one is there's currently no consensus or standard to qualify what is green or what is carbon neutral for a LNG cargo, right? So the 15 carbon neutral LNG deliveries, some covers the entire value chain from production, from pipeline transportation, liquefaction, shipping, regasification, and use, basically everything. But some carbon neutral deals, they claims, but only covered scope 1-2, that's production, liquefaction, shipping, not really the entire life cycle. And there's no global market yet. So most of the carbon neutral LNG deals are nature-based deliveries done by the individual suppliers. As you correctly mentioned, Shell, Total, such companies, they have their own company goals and also supported by the government or somehow pushed by the government. And also on the buyer side, like CNOOC, I think as a state-owned company, it has to sort of comply with the country's carbon neutrality goal in the long term.
Yeah, we could, you know, we could discuss this ad infinitum for days. Like it yeah. Again, it's kind of like I compare it to when the beginning of carbon credit markets that were, you know, it seems to me it's like trying to grab fog and put it in your hand and save it. Anyways, I'd rather talk about more prescient things and things that are prevalent in people's minds today. This past April, Chinese President Xi said that China will, quote, phase down, unquote, its immense fleet of coal-fired power plants in its 15th five-year plan starting in 2026. China currently gets, and I think I'm not right about this, about 60% of its electricity and about 60% of its total energy supply from coal. On the electricity side, that's annually about 4,600 terawatt hours just from coal in China, 1,000 terawatt hours more than total electricity use in the United States. Is it safe to say that China's move away from coal will have massive implications? And is it possible in the period that they're discussing, or are these, again, it's easy to set goals that are way out there? While renewables will certainly be used as well, China's indicated that natural gas, and you mentioned this earlier, I think we'd like you to speak a bit to China's increasing natural gas role, because it gets left behind in this whole new narrative about renewables.
Yeah, it's very well said. We can see a single move in China could have big implications to the global energy markets, like always, especially this the recent years. Gas will largely support power generation, industrial usage, and residential needs, of course. In the power sector only, as you mentioned, 60% of the electricity is generated by coal. Currently, 4% is from gas, 5% from nuclear, and 31% from renewables, including hydro. The share of coal is expected to drop to 45% by 2030 in our forecast and further to 22% by 2040. And the drop of coal consumption in the power sector will largely be compensated by renewable resources, especially wind and solar. But nuclear is also expected to have a robust growth and account
China is building several nuclear power plants at present, are they not? Like a dozen or something like that. Is that not correct?
It is correct. If you could compare with Japan, who is really struggling to make a decision if they need nuclear to support power, but at the same time to be safe, just lesson learned from the Fukushima disaster. So China is definitely having more capacity add on nuclear side. Now it's 5%. For power mix, but by 2040, we think nuclear will be around 10%, will be like double of to this share. But on the other hand, the share of gas is forecasted to increase to 6% by 2040 from the current level 4%. But the absolute power generation from gas by 2040 will be around three times of today's level. So the share is the increase on share is not that significant, but the absolute number is big. So
how many metric tons per annum would that be? Just to give people an idea, if you can answer that question.
Yeah, sure. We think on natural gas side, it will be around 520 BCM by 2030, 620 BCM by 2040. This translates to the LNG demands if we deduct the domestic gas production and pipeline, this will be around 150 million tons by 2030 and around 200 million tons by 2040.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it is. In today's markets, that's a very big amount. I'd like to, and apologize to you, Xi, that this isn't in the script, but or of our discussion or what we prefaced with, but Japan recently announced that a dramatic reduction in the amount of LNG they plan to use by 2030. Could you expand? And that was just out last week, and I can't remember the exact source, but I read it where they, as per prior projections, they're going to halve their LNG intake by 2030. Are you aware of that? And could you explain that a little bit? I don't understand the reasoning there for Japan to say that.
Yeah, sure. I think Japan's gas slash LNG share in the power mix is around 27%, if I'm not wrong. So within the new regime, I think it will be around 20%, or 19 to 20% of the power mix by 2030. So this will translate around 9 million tons reduction from today's target. So 9 million tons is not too much for a global kind of picture. But for Japan, I think right now they are about 75 to 80 million tons consumption every year. So we think by 2030 will be around, 65 million tons. With these new targets, will be another 9 million tons reduction. On the other hand, they have to bring in more renewables and new nuclear, of course, to make the security of the power system.
So have they made an announcement to go back to some nuclear power? I didn't see any of that.
No, but if Japan want to have a proper power system, they have to bring back some baseload capacity to the grid.
Yeah, it seems to me mostly political. I didn't understand the press release or why they would say that. It seems like you're showing a card that you don't have to show right now. I don't understand it. We're going to look deeper into that. And Joe's trying to chase down a potential interview with someone from the inside of the story there. But anyways, let's just finish up with a couple more questions about hydrogen. Australian LNG producers intend to diversify both blue and green hydrogen for export, particularly to Japan and South Korea. Do you think hydrogen shipping in Asia is realistic? And can it be cost competitive with other energy sources? It certainly isn't at present. Could you give us a bit of an overview from Rystad's position on hydrogen?
Yeah, sure. So on the supply side, Australia currently has around 5 operational green hydrogen plants and another 40 more or 50 more in the pipeline. And as you mentioned, the gas producers in Australia take really blue hydrogen as well as a natural transition in their business. Currently, around 50% of the world's hydrogen is produced by gas. And the levelized cost of the blue hydrogen is about $2 to $2.5 per kilogram, while the cost of the green hydrogen is more expensive. It's about $3 to $6 per kilogram, given the technology constraints.
Can you, sorry to interrupt, can you explain, can you convert a kg to MCF for me? How many MCF would a kilogram be? 30, is it 35?
I have a hard time
visualizing a kilogram of hydrogen.
Yeah, because you know you have to take the heat content.
Right, depends on what temperature it's at. Yeah. We'll just leave that there. We'll figure it out. Sorry, Chi.
No worries. So on the demand side, Japan currently consume around 2 million tons of the hydrogen this year, but many from the refineries. We expect the demands in Japan to grow to 14 million tons by 2050. So this will be largely driven by the steel producers, refineries, and the power generation sector. Similarly, in South Korea, the current consumption of hydrogen is below 2 million tons. By 2050, it will be around 9 million tons, mainly driven by the refinery and the steel sector. But as mentioned, for shipping, hydrogen is most relevant as a fuel alternative when it is liquid, which requires it to be stored at a low temperature, minus 250 degrees Celsius. This is called cryogenic storage. We do expect hydrogen to utilize the LNG infrastructure, though, and the value chain for the power generation. This would reduce the initial investment costs, raise the power generation efficiency, and lower the emissions at the same time. So in this sense, hydrogen can be a value-added option for LNG. But if we expand the timeline to a bit in the long run, hydrogen could partially overtake LNG as a cleaner fuel, and the installed capacity of hydrogen for power is expected to scale up in the late 2040s, both in Japan and South Korea. But by then, the coal will be the first fuel to phase out. So if we have to phase out a fuel, then coal will be the first one before LNG for hydrogen.
I guess, and I don't want to get into too deep into engineering, but you made a very interesting point when you suggested that, you know, LNG infrastructure is being built today, trains, the shipping, cryogenic processes should feather right into hydrogen production in the future and transport and sales in the future. But isn't hydrogen a lot more corrosive than natural gas compressed, or liquid natural gas? I wonder about that. Is there a move by the, you know, in a longer term energy strategy by the producers and the distributors and the LNG shipping points to be engineered to handle hydrogen in the future? Or is that going to have to happen later? Because it's a bunch more capital cost if you can't just make a simple transition.
Yeah, exactly. As you mentioned, if they can utilize the existing infrastructure from LNG, and if the technology is developed properly, then the capital cost could be lower than initially expected. But to be honest, we don't know, because the industry is still very small scale.
Right.
We don't really know on a larger scale how much really on capital costs and also risk operating costs can be added on top of this, the current level of LNG.
Yeah, it's an interesting part of the discussion, because it seems like, you know, there was 150 years of coal, then there's been 110 odd years of oil, with coal not gone yet. And I think that, you know, the transition, which is a loose term for the future of energy security, is interesting. And I think that if people took a longer view, that, you know, you couple the LNG trade with hydrogen trade 20 years from now, perhaps we would be better off at not being into the spikes and valleys of production and demand supply dynamics. Xi, thanks so much for joining us today. We always ask our guests one last question, because we have a very eclectic group of people that come on our show. And I'd like to ask you what you're reading these days.
I have to say, I'm not reading any books this week. Now is the best season of the year, the Norwegian summer. So I'm more into the mountains than books, to be honest.
You live in a very wonderful place. And, you know, there's so much to do, especially in summer, because in winter, it's dark a lot in Norway. Yeah. It was a very short day in the winter. So yes, you want to enjoy the outdoors while you can.
The next book, though, in my reading list for a long time, actually, is Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. But I haven't really started yet.
Well, we'll put that up on the website, and people can have a look at it. Xi, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to this episode of Energy Security Cubed on the Canadian Global Affairs Podcast Network. You can find the CGAI Network on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. If you like the show, give it a rating. You can also find the Canadian Global Affairs Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. If you like this episode and want to help us keep creating content, you can support us by donating at cgai.ca/support. Energy Security Cubed is brought to you by our team at CGAI. Thanks go out to our producer, Joe Kalnan, and to Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Kelly Ogle. Thanks for joining us on Energy Security Cubed.